tape too.
Frequently, all four of us kids were asked to go to the Big Creek 11 o'clock service with my father. And so we would go from Sunday school and walk the length of the main drag and meet my father at an intersection where he'd be coming from his earlier service, so he wouldn't have to drive out of his way, and also he was all never ahead of time. And he never hurried because he always said about his services, they aren't going to start until I get there. And so he would take his sweet time. Now that's something I didn't learn from my dad. My mother was always terribly prompt and ahead of time, and I am always terribly prompt and ahead of time, and have spent, you know, much of my life waiting for people who are not prompt. However, I anticipate that and always take something long to read or write or whatever. Mm-hmm. But back to the, so we did go to that one Sunday morning service with my father quite routinely. Then later on when I was singing in the choir and I would, you know, have to skip that. But we became quite well known in the, in fact, there are several pews in that Big Creek church that have my brother's initials carved in. I would never deface a church pew or anything else, but unfortunately, my brother Gordon had no qualms about doing that. Mm-hmm. On Sunday afternoon, lots of times I would ask if I could go with him, because when just the two of us were in the car, we had such fun. We would sing talk, but sing an awful lot. And furthermore, by the time I was 12, when we would get off the main road onto a real country lane, he would let me drive. So I have actually been driving a car since I was 12, although you couldn't drive legally in Wisconsin until 14 in those days. Uh-huh. But lots of other Sunday afternoons, my brothers and their friends, and sometimes girlfriends of mine, would go with my dad. We had several very special places that we liked to. There were some hills around the Toma area that he would pass on his way to Wyville or Valley Junction, where we liked to hike. So he would dump us out on his way to church, and we would have a couple of hours, and then we'd wait till we heard his horn honk. And or at Cataract, there was a country school. It had a round and round and had and some swings, which was another place. So we would put on our woods clothes and go there. And so we had, and I think Mother was always delighted when we would be out of the house. Sundays were a nightmare for her. She didn't behave as though she were having a nightmare. But to get all of us dressed and on our way, and then to juggle the timing of all these services, and then to have a noon meal, a real Sunday dinner ready, and then to clean up that mess and have an evening meal, and then for herself to be ready to go with my dad, which she did every Sunday night, was just a hectic kind of day. Mm-hmm. And there was a period of later, we were still in high school at the time, when my mother would really want to eat Sunday dinner out. We didn't do it very many times, there was a Brigson Hotel in Sparta that specialized in Sunday dinners, chicken dinner, whatever. Mm-hmm. And now that I think of it, it was such a, I didn't think of it at the time, what a relief to her it was and would have been if we had done it more often and regularly. But I'm sure she had to almost plead to have it done at all, and then my father would grumble about what it was costing. And that's another aspect of, I think there were many times when my mother would like to have done something that cost a little bit, and my father was always he was very generous in one sense and with us, but paying for a meal out seemed like an extravagance to him.
Yeah.
And not a recognition of all the energy that was being drained from my mother. Mm-hmm. I don't think he ever recognized that. He used to I think when she paid her cleaning lady, she would almost do it on the QT because he didn't like to have somebody else around, an outsider around in the house, and he couldn't understand why somebody who kept the house as neat and clean as my mother. She would do laundry twice a week. There was, you know, was
certainly
with four men with wash trousers and shirts. My dad's shirts had to be starched at the collar and cuff, the ironing, and they, in those days, ironed sheets and pillowcases and every item of clothing. So with, and on Thursdays, my mother would clean the upstairs, change all the sheets. On Fridays, clean the downstairs until it sparkled, and, you know, Saturday bake, and...
Did you carry that through in your marriage? Did you, when you first married, did you expect that you would also clean a different level of the house each week, day of the week?
No, I don't think my standards had ever quite been as high as my mother's were. And furthermore, the whole routine of spring and fall house cleaning has happily gone by the boards. But she did that. And, when we first moved back to Madison, and we had a couple years of underemployment before I went, the first year or so, I hadn't gone back to work. But even when I did, what I was paid at Edgewood and by extension for those part-time things, I hardly covered the babysitter. So that there were several years when we had no cleaning lady. And that was just absolutely dreadful because I would spend the weekends, Saturday and Sunday, doing groceries and cleaning, and I didn't have to set aside a day to do laundry because we have a washer and dryer.
Mm-hmm.
But I had less time with the kids to do family things because of domestic chores than I would have had, than I had the rest of the week, it seemed to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so as soon as we had any income at all, we hired a cleaning person and have the same one now we've had for 22 years. She tells me she's getting on in years, and I tell her she daren't.
Do you think that you were consciously aware when you were a young woman in your 20s? Do you think you had the awareness then that you seem to have now about how hard your mother's life was, relatively speaking?
No, I doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt it. I was a little aware of it. One summer, my mother was in the hospital for 6 weeks or so. She had a hysterectomy and then complications, and I was, I can't remember, but maybe 14. But we had no substitute at home, and so I did good cooking and cleaning. I also was playing golf that summer with the junior golfers, so I would get everything as close to done. But I even did canning and made jelly and jam that summer.
Oof.
Because those were things that were on the schedule. So I had some little notion of, my mother used to have to can. She would can meat. You know, some farmer would give us half a beef, and then my dad would keep coming home from a service with a crate of strawberries that needed to be done right then or they would begin to rot. And some of those things that were just a real added chore for my mother. The only time, and I've told this story many times, that my father ever used good sense, and that what an inner struggle he must have had, this person who wasted nothing. I mean, he wore the same pair of shoes he would polish them like a good military man. I forgot to tell you that he'd been a colonel in the Army Reserves and used to go to summer camp also. But one year, the Cataract Parish decided to pay him an annual salary. They paid him in pumpkins. This was during the Depression when no one in his parish had any money, so they loaded up his car with pumpkins. And he started home, and he thought to himself, that if he walked in and told my mother it's a load of pumpkins, that she might walk out the other door. And yet he couldn't bear to waste them, and he didn't dare let his parishioners know that he wasn't taking them home. And I suppose if we'd had nursery schools then, he could have let each kid have a pumpkin, but we didn't have. So at least he had the good judgment to stop at a quiet, dark place and dump all except four of them in the gutter someplace on the way home and not come into that. And for him to part with anything was a wrench.
I'm sure. Yeah.
But that he did.
I'd like to go back to the religion for just a second.
Yes.
Did you have something else you wanted to
no.
say? Do you think that it had an influence in terms of your social change? I'm trying to see the strain there, and it seems, was it a form of religion in which you did take responsibility for your fellows?
Yes,
I'm wondering what the transference was for you in terms of your later life. And
now, I never, when I came here to Madison, I didn't go to any... I went to things at the YWCA. In fact, I was an elected officer
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
And but I, after a few weeks here, I just didn't want to take the time to go to church.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't seem a necessary thing for me at all. A lot of my friends and people who lived in the same sorority house that I did went to church. And one or two years, a couple people prevailed upon me to sing in a Baptist choir when they did their Easter cantata, and mm-hmm. that was kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But when I wrote and told the family that I was doing that, they immediately said I was going to have to be immersed and began to tease me a little bit about that. So I did, I suppose, things that were sort of religiously oriented sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I was chair of the University Peace Federation and active in an open housing thing. But
mm-hmm.
I don't even know to this day, you know, how religious I am.
Mm-hmm.
I never did, even as a youngster, I never kind of knew what people meant with a lot of the rhetoric that went with
mm-hmm.
religion.
Mm-hmm.
Give yourself to God. I didn't know what that meant. I still don't know what
yeah.
it means. And are you saved and these things.
Well, how would you define what other people call religion for yourself?
I don't know. I think that it's terribly important to do what? Follow one's conscience. But as far as I'm concerned, that has less to do with whether I smoke a cigarette and how I behave politically and as a human being with other human beings. And my parents used to bring home as guests in our house any foreign missionaries that they would encounter anywhere. Partly just because they were hospitable, but also because they wanted us to have a chance to meet somebody who had lived in a different culture. And who had different perspectives on things. So, in fact, the only black people I ever met in my life until I came here to the university were ministers or missionaries, mostly from other countries, who were invited into our house. And I remember having my dad and I used to have a lot of political discussions that my mother wouldn't enter into, and the boys, I don't remember their taking much part in it either. And my father and I didn't mind disagreeing with each other at all. In fact, we both rather enjoyed it. And sometimes that would upset my mother. We didn't argue. I mean, we didn't call each other names, but we would differ about some things. And that kind of upset her a little bit. And we would always do this at the table when we were eating, when we had these discussions. But one time, and this was the one that I'm recalling, my father told an Eleanor joke. This was during the early days. My dad had been a Republican, a progressive Republican,
mm-hmm.
and until my own kids began to convert him to being a follower of Eugene McCarthy and George McGovern. I think he continued to be pretty much... Well, that's not entirely true either. He joined the Union at one point, too. But he had... This must have been in the early regime of FDR. And my father told one of these... They were very current in those days. Snide remarks about Eleanor Roosevelt.
About her appearance?
Well, or I don't
what,
remember
or
the
her activities.
Of the... but anyway, my father repeated one of these that he'd heard in it, and it troubled me. And I said, why? What don't you like about Eleanor? I said, don't you like her because she thinks niggers are as good as white folks? And it never had occurred to me, because my father was not a racist. And in fact, he deplored race discrimination as much as I had learned and have subsequently learned to do. And he had never realized that here he was making fun of Eleanor Roosevelt, whereas she was giving public leadership on this issue that meant something to him. That was the last Eleanor joke ever told in our house.
How old were you at that time?
I was probably in high school, so I was between 12 and 16.
Mm. And so it was important to you that Eleanor was there?
Yes.
Did you ever listen to her radio show or read her columns?
Yeah, a little bit. I didn't hear her much on the radio. And I remember her voice was not good. And in fact, a lot of my friends, older friends who did like her, didn't think her column was much either, my day. But... I guess I wasn't feeling critical, you know, like a critic.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember how terribly excited I was the time I met her in the National Museum.
Oh, tell me about that.
We just rode up on an elevator together, and I was surprised to see she was as tall as I am. And we just, you know, said hello, and that was about it. But it was just a very exciting moment for me.
Oh, I'm sure it was. And you were in high school at that time?
No, this time I was in Washington. That was during World War II.
Oh, all right.
But the conversation with my father was when I was in high school.
Yes.
But my father was changed with the times, too, and moved a bit. And when I was at the university, either first or second year, he came to pick me up one time or take me... He was in town and came to take me to lunch or something. And... When he walked in, I was living at the Alpha Chi sorority house. When he walked in, he said, I'd like to use the phone if I could. And that was kind of unusual. Usually, if he had to make a phone call, he would stop at a filling station and take care of it. And I said, well, sure, the phone is right there. He said, I have to call Brother Kulpinski. Or I'm not sure, I don't think I have that name right. And I thought it was another Methodist minister. And I said, oh, who's that? And he said, oh, he's president of the union and of state, county, municipal workers. My dad was a state parole and probation officer.
Mm-hmm.
And then he kind of, he wanted me to know this, but he just couldn't come right out, so he had to hem and haw around with this miserable phone call. And then he said, well, you know, I realize that the union has done a lot for those of us in my position, in salary and benefits, and that the least I could do is to join and pay dues. And so for a person who, you know, grew up with all the negative stereotypes of unions, to not only make that change, but then to have to confess it to his great critic, was kind of nice.
Hmm. September 22nd, 1987, K. Clarenbaugh. Well, Kay, to continue from last week, let's talk about your mother a little. You had mentioned that she had a full life, but in some respects was dissatisfied.
Right. Let me, I don't know exactly where to begin. I will begin by saying, I suppose, that my mother was a very warm and motherly kind of person. not only be loved by her own children, but by all of our friends and neighbors. And as we grew, not only when we were very young, but over the years, and so that our friends always liked to come to our house, and she was always quite welcoming to them. My mother had, I think I already have mentioned, that she taught country school and then taught in a couple of smaller communities, and in fact was a school teacher when she met my dad. And he was already in the state legislature, and he was the local preacher. She told me at one time a terribly funny story about their courtship. And I think she never dared to laugh to him or at him about it, because even in late years he was apparently still a little bit sensitive about it. But while he would be in Madison attending the legislative session, she apparently on some occasions dated some other person in town. And the joke that my mother told was that when my father found out about this, either from her or however, he said to her, suppose you went to eat some of that inferior ice cream at the ice cream parlor. And of course, it was the only place in town. But because she was with someone else, it was inferior. And she got a kick out of that. We all four of us kids, had a built-in tutor at our house in the person of my mother. She loved teaching. She used to tutor kids in town who were having trouble in school, and their mothers would call her and say, would you help with whatever it was, writing, math, whatever. And so by the time we were doing homework, which was not as prevalent in those days as it certainly has become, and what? We would sit around the dining table. My mother would sit with us and help. We always had an unabridged dictionary in my father's study. He had a study in our house. And in fact, in the dining room, in addition to studying at that table, we had a big blackboard that covered one whole wall where we could play and write when we were little, but we could do arithmetic, etc. And that's also where we left messages for my dad, phone messages. And my mother would write, funeral, 2 o'clock, etc. So they would be reminders to him. Much safer to leave messages for him on the blackboard than to leave a note on his desk, because his desk was always a mess. And he didn't like to have my mother help him clean his desk or his office. He knew just under which pile to look for what. He would let me help him clear his desk. I would take the time to say, where does this go, and where does that go? Whereas my mother would just want to do it in a hurry and shuffle things together. I always thought it was interesting that later on, when my own daughter Sarah was old enough to help Grandpa, he would let her help him clean his desk. But as far as I know, we were the only two people who ever were cheerfully allowed to do that. So that was, my mother also was quite a reader. I don't know whether I've mentioned on a previous tape her little arrangement with the Carnegie Library in Sparta, which was presumably the first one in the state, first Carnegie Endowed Library, was in our little town. But she had an arrangement with the head librarian that whenever they got in a new book, they would phone her at once and give her first dibs on it. So that she,
how wonderful.
We had a little place on the landing of our staircase where between the posts my mother would keep the library books that needed to be returned. And she despaired of my ever becoming a reader. Now when I was in the low grades,
continuing the K. Clarenbaugh tape.
Well, in any case, I did go to the summer reading programs at the library when I was just in the early grades, and would read the required 25 or however many books in order to get the diploma or gold star or whatever. But reading was not my favorite activity. In fact, all through high school, I think, I didn't read just for fun very much. I read a few books, especially those that I would receive for Christmas or birthdays or whatever. But
did you have any kind of, did you have a favorite kind of literature?
Oh, I loved Little Women, and earlier than that, the Bobbsey Twins, and Nancy Drew books, of course, I read. But I don't know that nothing very, very deep, I guess. And it was only in much later years that I began to read for fun and for something to do. But I was much too busy and with outdoor things all through high school, really, to ever have time to want to just sit and read.
And you mentioned sports, that your mother was able to play in competitive sports with other schools.
That's right,
girls
when she
teams.
Was in high school, Sparta High School, 30 years before I was. She graduated in 07. Yes, they used to go by train to Wisconsin Rapids and other towns and play basketball. In fact, she says that, told me many times about going when she had what they called Quincy in those days. Must have been like a, but it was a terribly sore throat, probably like a strep throat. And she would conceal that from her mother so that she could still go on the basketball tournaments or games. But by the time I was in high school, or well before that, interscholastic sports for girls had totally left the scene, had not been reinstated. My brothers were all on every athletic team. Of course, that's one of the joys of living in a small town. You do everything, because they need enough bodies to do it, although my brothers were fairly athletic.
But it sounds like you were, too.
Yes, I was. I captained. I recently had occasion to look in my high school yearbook when we had our 50th high school reunion this year. And noted that I had been captain of volleyball and basketball. And I don't remember that I was ever the softball captain, but I played softball. And did a lot of things that were not team sports. I played golf a lot, and swam, and ice skated, skied.
Did you continue those activities throughout your later life?
Not really. Swimming, and had every high hope of playing golf when we moved back to Madison 27 years ago, when we thought we'd be able to afford it. On Staten Island, golf was very expensive, so I didn't, by the time you paid a babysitter and everything, but that, those hopes were dashed along with quite a few other things when I went back to work and maintained a household with three kids. I just had to cut out quite a few things, one of which was the possibility of playing golf.
Because of time.
Because of time.
Yeah.
Another was concert tickets. The first few years we were here, we bought season tickets to the Union Theater performances and a few other things, and found that we were not using the tickets. And so I realized that was another aspect of life that would have to go for a while.
We'll get back to that. That's
interesting. What you had to give up to keep your professional life.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Professional and domestic.
And domestic.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You had talked about your mother's trips, that she took separate trips from your father.
She did. And they had sufficiently different interests. My mother had many friends and a few relatives whom she loved to visit, a sister in Florida and a sister in Texas, friends in California, and an aunt in California. And so that she would, not every year, but every few years, would arrange a trip for a couple of weeks and had a wonderful time. She loved planning the whole thing and accumulating wardrobe and making arrangements. And my mother came to see us. I lived far enough away from Sparta for enough years so that it was fun for them and for us to have my mother and dad come and visit. And they frequently came separately. My mother came many more times than my father did to visit us, and it was always, but whether either or both, it was always a red carpet event for my kids and for my husband and me when they were coming to visit. Their other two offspring, my two brothers, lived near enough, one right in Sparta and the other, you know, 25 miles away in La Crosse, so that it wasn't such a state occasion when there was a visit. But for us, we would plan it when we knew that either one or the other was coming, plan it for weeks in advance. Mm-hmm. Every menu item and every, the kids, we had to have pickled herring for Grandpa, we had to have this and that. And once my mother came to visit us by herself when we lived in St. Louis, on the occasion of David's birth, or when he was just a few weeks old. And my mother loved this when I told her. Sarah was four or nearly five, I guess, and came to me one morning while my mother was there, absolutely indignant, scolding me, this little five-year-old was. She said, "I think it's perfectly terrible the way you make Nina work when she's here." I said, "Make her work? What have I made her do?" Well, she was just making her bed, and I think it's terrible that you make her do that. My mother got an awful kick out of that, because actually we never had her lift a finger, except that she would read to the kids, and that was about the extent of what we made her do. Oh, she would also do a little mending for me and a few little chores like that. But the preparation that my children engaged in anticipation of any visit from my parent was fun. But I had visits from my mother and dad long before I was married, and a couple of them that I recall, especially in Washington during World War II. My youngest brother David was killed in a plane crash as an aviation cadet in 1943, I guess, early in 43. I was in Washington with the War Production Board. And this was a most devastating experience for my father, who thought there had to be a religious message in this. And as a very devout Methodist minister, he kept seeking, why did this happen? And why to him, I suppose. And, he even sought out other religious people to discuss this with. And in the process, in which he really behaved like somebody who was demented, well, I may exaggerate in the use of that word, but it was just constantly on his mind, and mm-hmm. and it was very, very hard on my mother, not only hard to lose her youngest child, but also to have to be living with my father when he was going through all this. So she wrote and kind of pleaded with me to invite him to come and visit me in Washington. She thought that getting away from home would be good for him, but it would be even better for her to have him gone for a while. So I did extend the invitation, and he did come. And we had all my friends rallied. We had a wonderful time, good meals, and ate out, and went to the theater. And then he left Washington to go visit his sister on Staten Island, where he was going to spend a week. And after he'd been there for 2 days, he telephoned me in Washington to ask if he could come back instead of spending the rest of the week with his sister, and would I please get theater tickets for the gang as his guest, and which we did. So it really did what my mother had hoped it would do. And it was fun for me. I had a few dread moments before he came myself, wondering, whether he was going to, upset me and my friends. But on the contrary, he entered into the whole activity, and it was good for him. And my mother came on a number of occasions to Washington by herself, and I particularly recall the time that she went with I had two friends with whom I used to go to the racetrack once in a while, and she thought that sounded like such fun that they arranged to take her one Saturday. And when I was not able to go, I had to work on that day. And so she took me into the little dressing room of our apartment and hauled out this roll of bills and wondered if that would be enough money to put on the horses. Of course, I just loved it, this idea of this country preacher's wife with her wad of money to go to the races.
Do you recall how she did?
No. It's possible she didn't ever tell me. But we never did go to the races in order to make money. We just took as much money as we needed to come and go and eat. And if we made a couple bucks, we'd put them right back on the next race. So, yeah.
You had also talked about your mother's role as an educator. I wanted to back up for just a second. Did she have to, was it necessary for her to quit teaching public school because she married? Was that a law in Wisconsin at the time?
I don't know if there was a requirement or if it was just de rigueur.
Yeah.
My hunch was that it was just the thing to do.
In some states it was a law.
Yes, I know it was, particularly during the Depression.
Yeah.
But of course, this was before the Depression.
Yeah.
My parents were married in 1913, and
A question that I wanted to ask was, as you look back on your mother, it's clear to me that your sense of family, certainly, and what family meant, came from the influences of your own family. But on a personal level, what do you feel, what qualities that you feel that you have, do you feel were influenced significantly by her?
Well, I think, I don't know, qualities so much as behavior. I don't know how one distinguishes that.
Sure, I don't either. Go ahead.
My mother was a very dignified person and a calm person, respectful of other people. There was never any sense of class in our family. That I think partly because of the kinds of people who came to our house, because my dad's office was there. Not only rural, but people of all walks. People who came to see him, be it for legal or for ministerial or for parole and probation or whatever.
And then
my mother's activity in the Church Women United and some of the school functions and other community activities. People were kind of evaluated as individuals and were respected as individuals. And I think that's something that has really, without ever saying it, you know, that you don't distinguish on the basis of people's income or rank or job title or whatever. We just absorb this. This is the way both of my parents behaved.
That they truly did not see themselves as being a class above.
That's right.
The other
or below.
People. Or below.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And nor did they see other people in that in that light. I think that's something.
Significant.
Then I think the whole way my mother brought up kids, again, treating us with respect, and I think we've done that with our children. Mm-hmm. Again, a lot of this is tacit. Nobody mm-hmm. ever said, you know, do this.
It's yeah. Just, now watch Catherine. This is
right.
How we do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Then the way we've celebrated holidays and birthdays, I've patterned just totally, I think, on the way things were done in my birth family and the way we liked it. I mentioned that on birthdays, everybody gets a present. And in fact, some of my Janet, for example, cherishes gifts she has received on David's birthday some times even more than things from her own birthday. And lots of Christmas packages and lots of celebration at Christmas time. And my mother had a knack of making us think we had the greatest Christmases that anyone in the world ever had by wrapping up necessaries, etc. And that was always fun. My mother also had a little store of gifts in a linen closet that she had upstairs that always smelled good from smelly soap. And she would just stockpile little guest towels or notepaper or a nice bar of soap or something, and would be able to haul them out even if she discovered that it was somebody's birthday or whatever. And that's, I think, something that I've also have mimicked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My mother also kept one little overnight case packed in case she was ever asked at the 11th hour to go someplace. She had several friends, women in Sparta who drove cars and who would occasionally want to go someplace that would involve an overnight. And I guess they knew that if they called my mother, she was likely to say yes. And so she never had to worry about did she have a clean nightgown or whatever. She kept this one just for occasions of that kind. Now, that I don't do.
You don't do
that? Well, I do have a traveling outfit of pajamas, robe, and slippers that I only use for traveling. And then I know they're clean and ready to go. But I don't keep them in an overnight case.
I sense, though, that you may have gotten some of your organizational skills just through living with your mother all those years.
Yeah, I forgot to say how highly organized she was.
I've sensed it.
Oh.
Yeah.
And with lists.
And the books on the staircase.
Yeah. And a place to, in the kitchen, she had a little, wasn't actually a desk, but it functioned as a desk. And she would write down menus and kept a running shopping list so that I don't ever remember her running out of stuff or having anyone have to run to the store because she was highly organized. Of course, in my very young youth, we could order from the grocery store, pick up the telephone, and read off your list, and it would be delivered. And the milkman came. In fact, the milkman with his horse, it was the same man who used to deliver when my mother was, before she was married. He was still, and the horse knew when to stop and when to start. And that was...
How nice. Let's move to your education now, your formal as opposed to informal education. Tell me about beginning public school.
Well, I probably was one of the longest students in Wisconsin at the time. I started school at the age of 2 1/2 and went until I was, 25, I guess, with a PhD, with just a few years out for other activity. But I did start kindergarten at 2 1/2, trailing my next older brother. And my mother was home with a baby, and then she'd have to dress the baby and herself and go trail down to school and drag me home until finally the teacher said, let her stay. And so stay I did, but for 2 1/2 years until I was old enough for first grade. And it was very disappointing to me not to be promoted along with the other kids.
And you had the skills to be promoted, it
sounds
like.
Well, I certainly thought I did. However, my last year in kindergarten, the teacher was very happy to have me there. I knew my way around, of course, so she could send me over to the other building to get a jar of paste or whatever supplies she might be out of. Also, I was very helpful to her in interpreting. There was a student in kindergarten that last year with a very difficult speech impediment, and the poor Miss Griswold, the teacher, whom I adored, couldn't understand this child, and I could. So I would interpret so that I was useful in that sense, too. I once had a birthday party that last year in kindergarten that my parents liked to remind me of. At the time, I naturally thought nothing about it, but on my birthday, which is October 7th, I brought the kindergarten class home for a party, for a birthday party, and I had issued the invitation verbally a few days in advance, but had failed to mention it to my mother and father. And the teacher didn't think to clear with my mother and dad because I was so responsible and our family was so inclusive in that it just seemed very natural. It'd be perfectly all right. Now, obviously, and so my mother and dad did not bat an eye when 30 kids and the teacher came hiking from school in the afternoon and never once said a word to me about why did you do this? And luckily, it was nice weather. Some years there's a little snow on October 7th, and some years it's practically still swimming weather. Well, this was a nice day. So we played games outdoors. My mother sent my dad down to the local dairy to get 5 gallons of ice cream and some cones, and those were the refreshments that were served. And I really was not challenging your technical abilities. But,
that's perfectly
the other day I was playing a tape that I had done an interview for this Annenberg project I'm doing and had taped Catherine East in Washington. And so the tape was sent to me by WHA, and I put it on and played halfway through, nothing was happening. And I was just furious. I thought, if they missed getting this.
Yeah.
And then it began in the middle of the tape, and I realized that was side two, and they had mislabeled the on the outside. So then when I flipped it over, it did begin at the beginning on side one.
Another important point, and this is side two of the second tape.
Mm-hmm. Good. So, where
were we? We were talking about your school experience.
That's right, and I got into kindergarten.
Right, and we've had the surprise on your mother birthday party.
Yeah. Well, I finally did make it into first grade, and then the first grade teacher had me take first and second grade in the same year, which was fine, because I had been reading, I think, quite a while before I started first grade. As a matter of fact, I think I got to be a junior or a senior in high school before it even began to dawn on me that people went to school to learn something new. I mostly went to school to kind of show off what I already knew, or I'm sure I was learning new things as I went along. But we had what I loved at the time, but I think was an unfortunate practice in my high school of junior high as well as high school. Students who had a solid A in a course were exempt from final exams. So I had never taken a final exam in my life until I came to the university.
Oh my.
And
how was it?
Well, it was a shock. In fact, I looked forward to those 3 days of vacation at the end of each term because while the other kids were taking exams, I would have a holiday. One year I did cheat. In junior high, my mother was a collaborator. I think of my mother as a completely honest person, and in fact, I think of myself as an honest person. But in seventh grade, we had to take sewing the first semester and then cooking the second semester, and the big sewing project was to make the apron that we had to wear in cooking class. And I never did really learn to sew, nor have I ever enjoyed, well, one year, when I was about a freshman or a sophomore in high school, I made 4 summer dresses because I wanted some clothes and we didn't have money to buy any. But that's about the extent of I got it all out of my system that one year. So here I was spending my holiday from taking final exams in seventh grade finishing up this apron so that I wouldn't flunk sewing. Finally, I was making such a mess of it that I sneaked it home and pleaded with my mother to finish it up for me so that I would pass from sewing into cooking. And she did. And I did, and I sneaked it back and probably got a B minus on it, but at least it was over and done with. My mother also collaborated with me on other things, but this was not really in the dishonesty department, I think. She was highly respected in our community and beyond. And I used to get a bee in my bonnet every year that I would like to play hooky sometime. And so my mother and I made an agreement that once each semester, when I really wanted to not go to school, that I should tell her that this is the day. And I never stayed home just to stay in bed or to, but I wait until there was a perfectly beautiful fall day or a perfectly gorgeous spring day and say, this is the day I don't want to go to school. I want to, you know, either go play golf or just take a walk in the woods or ride my bike. So my mother would telephone the school office and say, Catherine will not be in school today. She didn't lie. She didn't say I'd broken my leg or had the sniffles. Just she would not be in school. And the assumption at the other end was that I had a perfectly good reason not to be there.
Of course.
And I'd get it all out of my system, and that would hold me until next time. And I've always thought that was a good idea. Now, I don't know that my kids ever asked to do that or ever did that, but I do know that I've always had an attitude that when the world is too much with you, you should be relieved of some of it. And so I have tried to relieve my kids of excess pressure, encouraging them sometimes when they were in school to drop a course or to somehow lighten whatever, or to be helpful. If kids had one too many things to do, to remove one of them, do it for them or whatever. And I think that that's important for at any age. Not to have.
Have you done that for yourself throughout life? Do you feel that you've taken that to heart in your own management of your work and your family life and recreation?
I have. I don't know that I've always used good sense about which things I removed and which ones I retained, because I have the feeling that I have removed a lot of the fun things, such as the theater tickets and golf and going on vacations that may have cost more than I thought I should spend, so I didn't go. But I certainly have realized from the beginning, not the beginning, but as I've gone back to work, and that there still are 24 hours in the day and 7 days in the week, and if you're adding something, you jolly well better subtract something. And, I'm sure that my standards of... when I was 35, I remember my birthday. We were living on Staten Island. And I decided that I was probably, according to statistics, halfway at 35, now that the lifespan is extended for women a little bit, but... and that for the next 35 years, I was going to do a few things my way, and immediately decided I would never wear a hat, except in the winter to keep myself really warm, and that I could have guests for dinner without having to make rolls, yeast rolls from scratch, or a pie from scratch, and that there were just a few domestic things that I could do without. And it also was sort of an attitude that I had.
Sounds like you were deleting some of the things, perhaps, that your mother hadn't deleted. I suspect that.
Well, I don't know that my mother wasn't such a great baker.
So yeast rolls wouldn't have been a priority for her either. Huh?
No, but then she part of her Tom Sawyer bit that I spoke about earlier. It was a great privilege for me to be allowed to make dinner rolls
from
the time I was 10 or 12 and bake cookies. And to this day, I really enjoy making yeast rolls, but I don't do it very often. and I love to do donuts. My Aunt Carrie and Sparta, mother's sister, made donuts for the whole damn town. And she lived to be 82 or 3, and the last time I saw her, she had a little batch of donut dough always in her refrigerator. And when anyone stopped by, she'd say, "Let's have a cup of coffee." And she would knock up half a dozen or a dozen donuts to have fresh with the coffee. Mm. Well, I didn't want Aunt Carrie's recipe to go to her grave with her. So I made her make donuts several times, because she didn't measure anything and didn't know what the measurements were. So she would dump and then I would measure it. And so I got her recipe finally written down. Later on, discovered that it was quite similar to one in my Meta Gibbons cookbook, so that it was all right. But I still do donuts once a year or so. Uh-huh. I have a wonderful donut story, if you are interested in the donut story.
Oh, certainly.
When we lived on Staten Island, and Janet was an infant, she was born in August, and on Halloween, that's my favorite time to have homemade donuts. Sarah came home from fourth grade, and the day before Halloween, and announced that she had told her teacher that she would bring donuts for the class for Halloween, and she'd forgotten to mention it. Now, that was unusual for Sarah to forget to mention something, but I said, fine. Then I had to figure, how do I make... Donuts have to be fresh to be good. I mean, otherwise there's no point in having homemade donuts, I think. So I wanted to make them in the morning before, so that she could take them hot and fresh to school. But I had a four-year-old and a new infant, and I didn't want donut grease around, mm-hmm. well, with the four-year-old especially. So I got up at 4 o'clock, and before it was time to feed the baby and before David was around to be in the way. And my husband and I had a team of, we did donuts as a team. I would roll out and cut, and he would fry, and so that we could handle it, and I would chill it. Well, you don't need to hear the whole process right now, but we had fresh donuts for Sarah to take to school. Well, while...
So your husband got up with you then?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And about the time we were finishing the donuts, the baby was waking up and crying, and Sarah, who usually had good sense, 8 years old, said, "Do you suppose the baby would like a donut?" And, you know, 2 months old, August, September, October, maybe closer to 3 months, and instead of saying, "Don't be foolish," or "Are you joking?" I said, "Oh, I wouldn't give her a whole big one, maybe just a little round, you know, one of the whole." And when I went into a little while later, there was this cheerful little baby with donut crumbs all over her crib. So luckily she didn't choke to death on one.
Probably just sucked them.
In any case, the donuts were a hit in school. I didn't make donuts frequently for school, but cookies. Every year that my kids were in school, I was a room mother of whatever grade, and sometimes more than one grade at a, you know, one kid at a time, which didn't involve much. It meant making cookies a time or two or going to a program or something. But they always assumed without asking me that I would want to do it, the kids did. And I did always want to. So no, even though I was working full-time and doing other things, that was one kind of relationship and association that was just assumed. And I had the same assumption with my parents when I was growing up, that they would be not only willing but delighted to do anything that had to do with school.
And it carried on. Mm-hmm. And did your husband participate in, for example, PTA meetings or PTO or whatever?
Mm-hmm. He did. In fact, my husband and Judge Jim Doyle, both of whom died this year, we both had kids, Annie Doyle and David Clarenbach, were in the same room all through Randall School, well, all through high school. But Jim Doyle and my husband were the two fathers who could always be counted on to be at a school program over at Randall Grade School. Sometimes a few other men were there too, but those two inevitably, they would schedule their days to be able to be there. And lots of times I would watch Jim Doyle instead of watching the kids on the program because he was so sentimental, such a marvelous person. And he would be tearing. I loved watching him. So, you know.
Yeah.
Now, when when somebody was in senior high, Hank and I were urged to be the co-presidents of West High School PTA. And I, by that time, was up to my eyeballs in the women's movement and in other things. And I told my husband I didn't see how I could possibly do that. And he said that he would do all of the behind-the-scenes things that take all the time, the telephoning and setting up of committee meetings, etc., and that I could stand up and give the reports, which I didn't mind doing and which he was uncomfortable doing, and which was a total reversal from the other co-presidencies where the women would do all the scut work and the men would stand up and read the reports.
Oh, how wonderful.
So he thought that that was only divine justice, and he was willing to do that. And so so we did, and it worked out. And we did initiate a couple of good scholarship programs and a few things that were useful.
And you were philosophically of like mind, so that anything you would do would pretty much you'd be together on it. Yeah. Let's move back now. We're still following your education. You mentioned that that you didn't ever feel that it was new learning in school until you were a junior, but rather that it was an opportunity for you to show what you'd learned, which I think speaks to the kind of education that had occurred in your home. But tell me when the change occurred and what that was like.
Oh, I suppose my memory is faulty to begin with, because I can remember now that you, not that you're pressing me, but Oh, general science as a freshman and algebra and geometry.
The few toughies along the way.
But they never seemed tough.
Yeah.
They were always fun.
Yeah.
And my senior year in high school, when I had took physics, had the same science teacher I'd had as a freshman in general science. Another classmate of mine, Mary Cornell, and I loved physics, just loved it. And I would really work at even the little diagrams that we'd have to diagram the experiment we were doing would be a work of art, at least by my standards, and for me to do. But she and I had other ideas of things we'd like to do, so we bargained with the teacher, Walter Pribna. The physics room was not in use during the sixth period, which was a free period for Mary and me, and we asked if we could do extra experiments, things that that would occur to us. And so he said, yes, we could go in and use that room the sixth period, provided we didn't spend any of that time on the lesson for that day. He didn't want us to have an added opportunity that the other students didn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
So we not only agreed to that, but loved the arrangement. And he had a chemistry class next door, and he would stick his nose in three or four times during the hour, because he'd be so excited about whatever it was Mary and I were doing. that was something that I did that was lots of fun.
Mm-hmm.
My German class was fun. I took 2 years of Latin and 2 years of German in high school. And at our 50th high school reunion this year, somebody had written a little skit, and part of it involved this German club, and had a little part written in for me to do. And so that brings this back to mind. There were 14 of us in the German class, and we stayed the same 14 for 2 years. Had a marvelous teacher, Alvina Helmke. Well, very early, about maybe the first week or so of our first year in German class, we decided we'd like to have a German club, and could we meet on Fridays? So she said, well, sure, provided, with a few provisos, that in the 4 days before that, we would do 5 days assignments, and that no one in the class should fall below a 90 in any of these lessons, and that we spend German club talking only German. And we bought that whole package with enthusiasm. And of course, what teacher wouldn't be overjoyed? And for 2 years, that's what we did. And I was elected president both years of the German club, and immediately memorized some parliamentary procedure in German, which had absolutely nothing to do with the class, but it would always have the teacher in hysterics. And we collected a few dues so that on Fridays someone could run down to the local dairy and bring up treats for us. And then sometimes we cooked German meals. Once the German club conducted a pep rally in the gym and had a Schnitzelbank, Ist das nicht ein Schnitzelbank, which was all germane to the basketball team, etc. Mm-hmm. And we did a lot of very inventive things. We made up games in German. And so anyway, that was another thing that was just kind of fun.
Yeah.
During my senior year in high school, I sold tickets in the theater, in the movie house, which we call the theater. So I did that 7 nights a week and 2 matinees, and to earn a little money, $4.50 a week for those 9 times. And then in the summertime, between my junior and senior year and after my senior year, I, in the daytime, worked in a gift shop and got $7 a week for doing that. So I put all that money in the bank, and it was available then for when I was in college for spending money.
You know, as you describe your school experience, I'm so taken with what a, number one, you seem to have been an incredibly cohesive group with a good many teachers that you liked and respected and who were good teachers. Did you have any disruptive elements in your schools? It's so striking when we look at it in contrast to
right.
school today.
I don't, what we thought were disruptions in those days, you know, were exemplary behavior today.
Yeah.
So there was nothing like, there were always kids being sent to the principal's office for one little infraction or another, but nothing. I did some practice teaching while I was still in high school. My sophomore year in high school, in a social studies course, we had to select a career and then find an opportunity to do something with it.
Wow.
Well, I wasn't very imaginative, and so I thought I selected teaching as a career. And so I was supposed to find a place to, so I asked around, and some of the junior high teachers, you know, said I could come in and conduct a class. Well, one of them was a man who was an assistant coach, Orv Kane. In fact, I think he lives in Beaver Dam and teaches. He may be retired by now. Probably is retired by now. But he taught geography and something else in junior high. And he used to come to our house and play pool, billiards in our basement. I think he just was overjoyed to have an hour off. And so he would ask me to come back and teach another geography class. I mean, I did the few that I had to to fulfill the assignment for my social studies class. And so I would be pleased when he'd invite me back. Well, then the word got around. Well, I don't suppose it's a secret in a school system that size. And when a teacher would have to leave early for an emergency and be gone for an hour or two, the office would sometimes fish me up from wherever I was and ask if I would take the class, whatever it was, English or history or whatever. So I did a little of that, not an awful lot, but I was apparently on call for the rest of my high school
Do you
days.
Recall what you thought about it? Were you initially frightened, like a student teacher in college might be now when he or she has reached their senior year and it's finally time to step into the classroom for the first time?
I don't recall being uneasy about it.
But you, public speaking was comfortable for you even then, wasn't it?
I did a lot of public speaking in school.
Yeah.
We had a good forensics program in our school system. And in fact, I think I started public speaking when I was in early grades. I would be put on programs to recite poems or whatever. And then my mother had me take lessons, elocution lessons. Mm. The piano teacher, who was also the music teacher in the school, gave little, maybe I was her only student, I don't know, but I would memorize poems and and then she, or sometimes some prose things. But by the time I was a freshman in high school at age 12, I went out for extemporaneous speaking, it was called then. It has another title now, but what we had to do was to be prepared on about a dozen subjects, and then on the day of the contest, whoever was in charge would draw a title out of a hat, and you would go and prepare or recall or whatever. And during that freshman year, we had contests between Sparta, Viroqua, and Toma, a three-way thing, and then a regional in La Crosse, and I won both of those, first place, and went to the state contest in extemporaneous speaking for 2 years. And then I got a little bit weary of doing that, and then I guess I was on the debate team, and that took enough of that sort of time for me. So I just did extemporaneous reading, which didn't involve that kind of intense preparation or any nervousness about what they were going to draw out of the hat, because it didn't matter. You'd have half an hour to look it over and do the readings. I also went to the state contest in extemporaneous reading and had some interesting debate experiences. And so that was easy enough for me to do.
Yeah. Do you remember how you felt about teaching? Did you enjoy it, or did you find it something?
You mean what I did in
when you
days?
Were young? Yeah, did it actually confirm a career choice for
absolutely
you?
Absolutely not. I mean, I loved doing it because in the first place it would get me out of a class, and it was fun to do, and I did it seriously. I mean, I had no intention of becoming a teacher, and every year when my dad would line up. There were always three of us in undergraduate years together. He would line us up to write out the check for the tuition and room and board, and would ask what we were studying, etc. And he always put the question to me the same way, is this the semester you go into the School of Education? So I could always honestly answer no, because I had no intention of, but I didn't see any need to debate it. And when I would tell him that I was majoring in political science, again, he would, political science? What do you do with political science? And I would hem and haw a little bit. And
was he putting real pressure on you, or was this simply his way of communicating at the time of the check? I mean, did you feel that he would have been happier had you transferred to education?
I don't. I think he thought I should have an objective, a career objective.
A usable degree.
Yeah.
And
But
he wouldn't have withheld the money.
Oh,
if you,
no, it wasn't related at all.
It was more rhetorical.
Well, no, I think he really thought I was preparing or ought to be preparing to teach or to do something.
What did you feel you were doing?
I was learning a lot of things I wanted to learn. And also, what I heard about the School of Education left me so icy cold. And when I would see kids who were taking courses in the School of Education, I thought, I don't want that. And then I had professors who would make fun of it. Bill Ebenstein, who was one of my favorite political science teachers, used to say, I wonder how Socrates could ever teach. He didn't go to the School of Education. I was the valedictorian of my class, so I spoke at the commencement ceremonies, and I had the lead in our senior class play. I don't know if I've told you this.
No, you haven't. No.
I told somebody that early in that year, early in my senior year, the woman who was going to be directing the senior class play spoke to me very privately and secretly and asked if I would be able to leave my job of selling tickets at the theater long enough to rehearse for the senior class play and to be in it. Because if I could, then she would select a play that would have a part especially good for me. Mm. So I kept her a little secret, and of course told her yes, by all means. And all year long, whenever that thought would occur to me, I kind of pictured myself as Katharine Hepburn. And I thought, oh, I just, you know, wanted a role like one of those Hepburn things. And of course, when the play finally came, I was so glad I hadn't breathed any of this to a soul, because the play she had selected, and my part was of Sophie, an old maid. it was a dumb play, the kind that lots of senior classes do. It was fun, and at our 50th reunion, the fellow who played opposite me in the play was there and was reminiscing about it, and he told me 50 years later that he was so concerned that he had asked me at rehearsal one time whether my parents would be at the play, and I said, well, of course, and so will my brothers. Why? He said, oh, don't you think this is a little risque? Because I was in the play faint at one point. He had to pick me up and tote me someplace. He thought maybe my parents would be offended.